I'm Andrew Marzoni.
I'm Toby Wilson Bates.
And this is The Office Hour.
It's podcast time.
And we brought the house.
This is a very special episode for the first time. We have two guests on our show. And also for the first time, we have a returning guest, which is Dr. Anna Ioannis. Hello, Anna.
Hello. Glad to be here again. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you for being here. And then we have another guest, Dr. Jennifer Forsthoffel.
Hello.
Thank you for being here, Jen.
Absolutely.
The reason that Toby and I have brought all of these people here today.
All two of them.
Is to talk about our sort of experiences in the last week being teachers of rhetoric and communication and critical thinking in the wake of Donald Trump being elected president of the United States, which happened just under a week ago today. So I thought maybe we could start by looking at this McSweeney's piece that's been going around. Did you guys see this?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's called A Post-Election College Paper Grading Rubric. And probably the best part of this is the sort of A excellence category of the rubric, which is here labeled winner, huge, tremendous. Under the category argumentation says, high-level repetition of simplified point or slogan, advanced use of the red herring, arguments are untainted by facts or evidence, blames professor, classmates, and everyone else, insists that if the paper does not receive an A, the rubric was rigged and the professor, department chair, and president of the university will be sued. I had my students read this today. I think the target of the satire is pretty self-evident. Though, what I argued was that there's sort of a darker side to it, too, that, like, potentially this is what higher education could look like in a Trump presidency if higher education, you know, continues to exist in a Trump presidency.
This is something that I saw earlier that I was reading, this piece by David Tollerton in The Guardian called In the Age of Trump, Why Bother Teaching Students to Argue Logically?
Yeah, I read that today.
Which I thought, I actually wasn't as excited by this piece as I thought I would be when I started reading it. And I think because he has a really narrow definition of what logic is, and it seems like it's basically what he thinks. And what seems to me is somebody coming from a very old school British approach of what a strong logical argument is. I actually think that Trump and, like, Trumpism as a phenomenon has a very coherent internal logic that isn't super hard to interpret. I don't think it's the death of logic so much as just the sort of emergence of a potentially suppressed or at least hidden from view, very clear logic.
I should say really quick before we get into that, one of the reasons for having Jen on the show is that we're currently co-teaching a class that's about the presidential election. It's called The Rhetoric and Spectacle of Presidential Politics. But anyway, go on, Jeff.
And yeah, I think it was really, the thing about the class that was really interesting is we've been talking about both the role of presidential rhetoric as it exists in the present, but really how it's operated in the past and what trends are sort of happening now that haven't been in the past and vice versa. And there was never a question that presidential rhetoric matters and that it's impactful and that the rhetoric that our president uses in some way shapes the identity of American culture. It creates definitions. It creates our understanding of boundaries and even, I wouldn't argue, appropriateness and things like that. But when... You know, there was also, you know, an element of discussion in that in which we recognize that the president himself is somewhat of a figurehead. He's a representative for larger bodies. And I think that my students really ran with that idea because their response to the election was largely, really like it's not a big deal, you know, that, I walked in on Thursday morning very concerned and expected a level of just somewhat concern from them. And they were all very, very confident in saying that, this election wouldn't make much of a difference, that Trump as a president wouldn't be that impactful. One, because he's not going to do the things he says he's going to do. That was just, fiery rhetoric to get people to vote for him, but now he's going to calm down. And really, the president doesn't have enough power to do the things that he says he's going to do in general. And that was a really frustrating realization for me, or a frustrating thing for them to reveal to me that they felt that way, because it seemed to contradict a lot of the things that we'd been talking about throughout this semester, the impact that the president has on so many different things, not to mention the fact that this particular president has opportunities that are coming up in the very near future that will be impactful.
Well, in this, I mean, this is related to sort of the argument that I've heard from you guys, which I, have over the past few days come to kind of refute personally, which is that, it is clear that we now live in a culture that does not seem to value the kinds of things that we are trying to teach our students, which is absolutely true. I mean, I think that's clear. I think the kind of crises in the humanities and higher education at large that have been talked about for the last 30 years are like evidence of that fact, right? We're still in the same culture war. But I do not think that means that what we do is like less important or matters less. I think if anything, it's evidence that it matters more.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this is an interesting kind of nodal point that, for a long time, we have all taught freshman writing with the kind of implicit understanding that if we do our job well, our students could potentially become the president one day, right? And what this is showing is that even if we don't do our job well, or perhaps especially if we don't do our job well, then our students could end up becoming the president one day. And while that's a kind of sad thing to realize, I think, if anything, that's one of the best defenses I've heard for, like, teaching critical reading and critical writing and critical thinking.
Yeah, I mean, Aristotle's definition of rhetoric is the available means of persuasion. And that doesn't mean that, like, an effective topic sentence and developing, peer-reviewed research information is the available means of persuasion. The available means of persuasion may be shouting dog whistles into a crowd of angry people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's still use of rhetoric. That's...
So is that what we're... So that, does it change, then, what we need to be teaching about how to communicate effectively?
I think it might encourage us to think in more robust ways about the kind of ethical force of the humanities, right? Like, I think for humanities educators, and this is a debate in literary studies, right, too, is like, does reading make you a good person? Do the arts make you a good person, right? Like, that often, and I'm definitely guilty of this, like, the value of argument, or like, let me back up, but right, like, there's not actually a sort of ethical overtone to what Aristotle says, right,
in
the available means of persuasion.
Yeah,
right?
That doesn't mean you're going to say something really nice and charming if you're really persuasive.
Yeah, so if we're interested in ethics, it seems like a good opportunity to think in careful ways about what that looks like.
Well, and I mean, with Aristotle too, you know, rhetoric isn't a thing that is supposed to exist in a vacuum either.
Yeah.
Right? There is the consideration of ethics that is supposed to go hand in hand with that. So, yeah, I mean, I think if anything, you know, President-elect Trump is a wake-up call that our job is not to, you know, produce goods like neoliberal citizens, as maybe we have taken it for granted that it is to be, but rather in a pretty fundamental way to, like, work against the norms of the culture as it has revealed itself to be.
But there's also this fear. One of the points that I was thinking about for this podcast was this, the contradictory nature of our positions as professors in this moment, or teachers in this moment, to be objective and to talk about things in a way that is absent of some kind of, like, ideological bent, mm-hmm. that we are supposed to be more allowing them to express their ideologies while we keep ours quiet or less apparent, and how if we are now sort of thinking of our jobs as having a pushing against current cultural norms, in what way are we then positioning ourselves to get into some trouble, you know, in terms of this idea of what the position as professor is supposed to do in terms of objectivity. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so those things seem to be at odds with each other. And that is something I think that all semester and we've been...
I think
it seems like a real challenge
yeah.
for y'all.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely on the face of it for the two of you, but I think that's, like, as old as education, too,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, half the things we teach are about the sort of falsification of objectivity and how you don't actually get to have a non-biased sort of culture-free position from which to rain down knowledge. This is just us having to live that in some meaningful kind of way.
And, I mean, I think that we're at a real kind of crisis moment in the wider culture regarding objectivity, too. I think the news organizations that have come out, you know, of this election with any ounce of self-respect are the ones like the New York Times and the Washington Post that took an explicitly activist stance and were, you know, not trying to hide behind a veil of objectivity. Right. You know, I think that there's been a lot said in the news recently about CNN and how, you know, early on in the election, they were giving a lot of airtime to Trump rallies, just figuring, you know, if it's an event, then it's worth covering. And they backed off from that and have endured jeers of Clinton News Network. But it'll be interesting to see, you know, to what extent they embrace that moniker and how meaningful that will be to the world of journalism. But all of this to say, I mean, I've seen a lot of parallels in the worlds of higher education and journalism for a long time in terms of the job market and the cultural value and the monetization and all these things. I mean, what if this will certainly be challenged by a potential, you know, Dr. Ben Carson, Secretary of Education?
He said no.
Yeah, he said no.
He said
he's
no?
He's not going to do it. Yeah, it just came out and said no.
He ironically, after running for president, he ironically said, I'm unqualified for this position.
Yes.
Right. Well, okay, well, that assuages my fears a little bit. But, I mean, definitely it is still a scary thought. But, you know, to what extent are we obliged to not be objective?
Well, and this is the reason tenure was created, right? Is so that we in higher education
are protected,
that we can make informed intellectual arguments that might be disruptive to certain people in positions of power. And that, I mean, that was really the foundation of why tenure was put into place. Now, particularly in our field, it is becoming less and less of a, you know, option for us. And so in what ways does that, too, put into place a difficulty with both engaging with what it seems to be our ethical obligations as well as our sort of...
And their intellectual obligations, yeah. too, right? Like, if a part of the point of tenure is to protect speech for the pursuit of kind of more... some kind of more rarefied knowledge or objective knowledge, you know, which I say with some skepticism, right? Like, these questions aren't just about, like, creating good citizens or something like that, but about, like, what counts as knowledge in the academy anyway, right? And being enabled to teach it.
Advance it.
And advance it, yeah. Right?
And just to bring in the ghost of Immanuel Kant for a moment, who says, right, like, objectivity is not something we have access to, but within subjectivity, there is the pose of objectivity. This is objectively beautiful for me. Mm-hmm. And I think what that means for me in a kind of pedagogic space is that if I had, like, a really ardent Trump supporter in my class, I would, like, entertain those arguments, attempt to empathize with that person, and, like, at least create the space within which, like, that is objectively equal. And then you can, like, work through that logically that mm-hmm. I don't think is necessarily happening in the public sphere all the time. So maybe in that way, like, a kind of Kantian idea of objectivity is still something that can be preserved in the classroom and actually allow for this space of debate that doesn't seem to be getting, like, particularly exercised in, like, the social networks or something.
But it's also, that extends, I think, not to all classrooms, but particularly a classroom of 18-year-old students who have left their parents for the first time. I mean, saying, you know, having a student that supports Trump articulate that argument, that's a lot to really ask of them. Because I think there, particularly in my class, there's a lot of students who are in my class who support Trump who can't articulate in a very coherent, much less logical, or, you know, coherent or logical way, why they do, beyond the idea of, and when it comes down to it, my parents do, or I don't like Hillary, or something, you know, that isn't necessarily founded.
I like red hats.
I like red hats, you know, something that has nothing to do with sort of let's entertain that logically and work through it. That isn't exactly what is available to us and the classroom spaces that we are operating in.
And I think this is what I'll just to keep on harping on this David Tollerton piece, that, like, imagining that there is no logic, or that the logic is so deeply flawed as to be just comical, destroys the possibility for any kind of discussion.
Well, how would you describe that logic, then?
The logic of the Trump phenomenon?
Yeah.
This is, I had a student ask me this in class. Has everyone seen the movie Snowpiercer?
No.
That's, no. Is that the one with the train?
Yeah. So, very simple idea. There's a train. Like, the Earth has frozen. Climate change happened. But there's one train left that's completely self-sustaining that runs around the planet every year. The rich people live in the front. The poor people live in the back. The poor people eat bugs. The rich people in the front live very well. At a certain point, Chris Evans, who is, I think, intentionally chosen as a central character because he's Captain America, leads a revolt of the poor people to get to the front of the train to take over the train. Right, like, very simple social allegory. He frees this person who's in prison, who was the person who designed the security system for the train, and that person is, like, helping him get to the front of the train. They get to the front of the train. Chris Evans is like, I want to go in there, and I want to, like, kill, was it Wilfred, or whoever's running the train. He's played by Ed Harris, who's a god. And the other guy's like, no, I want to destroy the train. It's like, don't go through that door to the front of the train, go through this door off the train into the Arctic wasteland. And at this point, like, at this point in the movie, you're really torn up. And he goes in the front of the train. Sorry, this is a spoiler. He goes in the front of the train. Ed Harris is like, I've been waiting for you to put you in charge of the train. And he basically gives him this argument whereby Chris Evans is just going to have to repeat the entire system of the train. So he'll just take the front position, and then the social structure will remain unchanged. And at this point in the movie, you're really driven to want to destroy the train. Like, you have this real impulse, and more spoiler, the train does indeed get destroyed. There's this Edenic moment where, like, two a boy and a girl survive the crash, this kind of thing. And I was like, I think this in part is what the Trump phenomenon speaks to, is that, like, for some people, under certain conditions, it's more desirable to destroy the train. That I think Trump, someone who I don't think, I heard a statistic the other day, 60% of people doing exit polls said Trump is not qualified to be president, which means there's like a big chunk of people in there who think he's not qualified who voted for him. And I think it's because they're, for whatever reason, they're sick of, like, our political system, of the Democrat-Republican thing.
Burn, baby, burn.
Yeah. Well, think about this. If Bernie had won the Democratic nomination, he's not a Democrat. It never has been up until he ran. Trump has never been a Republican, basically, up until he ran. We would have had two people running who weren't really from either party. Like, people are so sick of the parties that they're more willing to destroy the train than find a way to make it run well.
Last week on election day, before we knew the outcome, Toby and I recorded an episode of the podcast, which I don't think is going to see the light of day.
I laughed a lot back then.
Yeah. part of the reason we decided not to air it is because of how, maybe not even how naive it sounded, but how naive I felt in retrospect prior to sitting down to edit it. But I think the ironic result of that is that what we were doing is Toby and I were discussing sort of literary predecessors or possibilities for literary predecessors for the current or the now past presidential campaign.
Yeah, to describe the campaigning that had just happened.
Right.
I talked about Animal Farm.
And I talked about Infinite Jest and The Magic Christian. But in all of these literary predecessors, we found, the Trump figure won, which was something that I don't think that we, like, had really fully considered at the moment. I think we were kind of in denial as, like, much of America has been. Another question, and maybe this can be the last thing we discuss today, is
already? I feel like we just started.
It always feels that way. But we've been talking for half an hour.
Oh.
Why do you think we were in denial about the possibility of this?
Because if I can say, I believed that this country, the voters of this country,
the Electoral College.
The Electoral College. But really, the people who are voting in this country had this sort of foundation of goodness that I believe I have. You know, this, that in the end, good will prevail. That being a person who is not racist or bigoted or homophobic or sexist, that will win in the end, and that those ills will be, there will be consequences for showing that candidate showing that ugly. I believe that. That's why I was so shocked.
What I would say, this is the thing, and I wish I could remember the full quote. So when Timothy McVeigh is on trial after, you know, the whole Oklahoma City bombing thing, he called the government, like, the great teacher. And basically it's because what the government did at the Branch Davidian compound, where, you know, they killed a bunch of people. I mean, that's its own mess. He said, therefore, he had to kill in response. Once his government kills, it has taught him to kill. And I think that part of what's been happening in our political discourse for the last several years is that politicians have been teaching us to hate politicians a lot. You know, like, almost every politician. One of the weirdest things about the Republican primary was how fast various actual politicians, like, tried to sprint to this outside position of, well, I'm not a politician.
Right.
But the problem was you had people running who were actually not politicians, right? Like, in a way, like, Ted Cruz's argument that I'm not Washington, like, killed him, you know? And so I think there's a real danger to that. I think that it was ultimately, clearly, a winning strategy across governorships, state legislatures, the House, the Senate, the presidency. So you can't argue with it as, like, a strategy that has been successful. However, I think it is incredibly dangerous because it involves undermining the very thing that it pretends to seek to build. And so there's this problem, but I think in some ways this election was a referendum on that idea.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is going to sound terribly cynical, and I'm only half kidding when I say this. It's like, I couldn't believe that Trump won because, you know, to borrow his phrase, I thought the election was rigged. Which is to say that I really didn't believe that the system would allow an outsider to take over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, to quote Karl Marx, he says that capitalism carries its death in its own belly. That, in a way, the thing that destroys the system is, in this case, the thing that is most coddled and brought up by the system.
Well, this is what Slavoj Žižek was saying.
Screw that guy.
We can take that on another day.
Yeah. Can we add one more question to the end? Or do you want to answer this question?
Anna should answer the question.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I do feel like I think we're sort of sifting through the kind of narrative building aftermath right now. And there are like a million threads, right? Like a million interpretations about how this happened. Media, right? Sexism, racism, you know, and they're also taking shape along kind of different logics, right? Like a logic that says, one thing that I've seen is, you know, I'm shocked, but I'm not surprised. This is not, in fact, there's plenty of racism in this country, right? Is the logic like that builds that argument, you have to buy into a certain whole other set of like definitions of racism and sort of critical theories of race for that to make sense, right? I'm dodging the question a little bit. I'm not sure I really know. I'm not sure I'm really sure.
I also don't think this was a definitive election. In many ways, this was the least definitive election of the last, like, 20 years.
Absolutely.
Because Hillary won the popular vote by a significant amount.
Mm-hmm.
Trump won the Electoral College pretty dominantly. But, like, those things, they're, like, while he is the president, no doubt there, like, they don't suggest, like, any kind of mandate whatsoever.
Right.
So much as a country of people who are kind of like,
Well, but it also, I mean, it is a watershed moment in the sense that it confirms that the direction the country seems to have been going in for, like, I feel like at least the last 4 years, but probably more like the last 8 or the last 20 or the last 30 years, is that it is in fact going in that direction. If the Obama administration was Reconstruction, then we are potentially entering a Jim Crow period right now. And, you know, hopefully it lasts 4 years or less.
That would be great.
That would be wonderful. You had another question you wanted to ask, Jen.
I want to know if you guys have an idea of what is going to change about the way you teach, and now that Trump has been elected president.
I think if today was any indication, which it may not be, I feel less afraid to air my personal beliefs with the knowledge that, like, given what they are, whether or not I air them won't make a difference in whether I am, like, fired, right?
Yeah, that's pretty ballsy.
That is ballsy. Yeah. That's my... I'm terrified of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see how long that attitude
is. But next week on The Office Hour, just so
got me through the day. Should edit it like someone knocking on the door.
Then just a Ben Carson sound clip.
Yeah. I'll put that in there. Yeah. I'll put that in there.
Did you watch the video of him?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
There's the video of him saying, I actually have an idea for that Department of Education.
I know where to store grades.
Yeah.
What about you, Anna? What do you think?
I mean, so sort of along the lines of like this question of objectivity, which is something that I believe in, right? Like I'm committed to creating a lot of space for my students to express themselves in my classes and to develop tools for making that expression with attention to audience, with attention to evidence and stuff like that. But I think one of the things that I'm thinking about a lot lately is that the terms of the debate, it can help our students to learn better to expand the terms and the voices in the debate. And I have been thinking a lot about strategies for bringing opinions that students might not already have or share into their conversation while also kind of protecting myself from the accusation of pushing those views on students or something like that. And it's like, it's a little bit one of those like, oh, duh moments. Like, why have I been thinking that like introducing an idea is the same thing as demanding it? And how do I continue to be really conscientious about managing that role?
I'm going to try to incorporate more, I don't know if service learning is quite the right phrase, but some sort of genuine effort for students to take what they are learning in the classroom and see how it exists mm-hmm. in a space outside of the classroom. Mm-hmm. Because I believe that that's something, that sort of practical element, or the way that things sort of translate from this more abstract to a more concrete way, that's a space that I think that I want to really work on and push for understanding with my students as a result of this election. I'm super stoked. I'm teaching a class on feminism next semester, and that's going to be really interesting in light of this election. I don't know if you can put this in the podcast, but I'm hell bent on getting my students,
You said hell.
That's to no say vagina early and often throughout the course and yeah. to feel comfortable talking about women and women's bodies and women's experiences. And in some way, this election has encouraged me to think about what assignments or opportunities can I put into the class that have them take that discussion and put it into a more concrete context.
This doesn't necessarily need to be where we end this, but because that was actually really inspiring. For a long time, when my daughters were 4, 2, and 7 months, obviously 7 months old isn't talking, but they started talking, then they were like mentioning their vaginas, I would say like bottom. And my wife was like, no, that's their vagina.
That's their vagina.
And now they call it their vagina. And I'm like, yeah, right on. But like, it's interesting that me, like a man in his 30s is still like confused, even for like a little bit of it. So yeah, let's vagina it up, by all means.
We'll see. We'll see how it goes.
I'll just to show solidarity, vagina. I think we should end there. Thank you guys so much for coming.
Yeah, this is a delight.
Thank you.
And come back soon.
Okay.
Anna could be our first 3-time.
Yeah, right? You can be our second 2-timer.
I'm sure I'll be back.
The Office Hour is produced by Andrew Marzoni and Tobias Wilson Bates, Britton Fellows in the Writing and Communication Program at the Georgia Institute of Technology. To find out more about the topics discussed, see our page at textile.lmc.gatech.edu. Thanks for listening!